Welcome to a new episode of Dan Marcus's Wax Museum. I'm obviously Dan Marcus, and my guest today on the phone is Dean Torrance of Jan and Dean, great storyteller. You're going to hear the story about how he came to sing the lead on a Beach Boys song. It's pretty well known that he sang the lead on Barbara Ann, but how did that come to happen? And why wasn't Jan there? You're also going to hear Dean tell a story about a major international incident that was indirectly credited to Jan and Dean by USA Today. Plus, Jan and Dean are famous for the song Sidewalk Surfin', song about skateboards. Where's the most famous place that Dean went skateboarding? You're also going to hear about the time that Jan and Dean showed up at a concert and there were no cars in the parking lot. Very logical explanation why. That's coming up. First, a reminder, you can find our website at danmarcuswaxmuseum.com. Also, find us on Facebook, Dan Marcus's Wax Museum, and please like us there and spread the word so more people can enjoy these stories about the artists and the songs of the 1960s and 70s. Sit back and relax. Here's part two of my conversation with Dean Torrance. Dan Marcus Wax Museum, this time around, part two of Dean Torrance. This Is Your Life. Hello, Dean.
Hello, Dan. It's the Dan and Dean show.
Yes, it is. Thank you for that. There's a picture out there of Dan and Dean singing Barbara Ann, by the way, on the internet.
Oh, my God. I think you sent me that.
Yes. Yes. You pushed me out on stage, and I'm standing next to you, and we're singing Barbara Ann, and I'm hearing that so familiar, iconic falsetto right next to my left ear. And I'm going... This is unreal. This is unreal.
But my band members really kind of, especially with Barbara Ann, kind of moved back from my microphone a little bit. Because my keyboard player described my falsetto as being able to crack frozen food.
That's in a good way.
I don't know
though,
if that's
Dean.
A compliment, but it's an interesting observation, I suppose.
Well, it's truly an iconic song, and your voice is so trademarked, you, that there are only a few famous falsettos in the history of rock and roll. There's Frankie Valli, there's Lou Christie, and there's you, I think. So that's a compliment.
Yeah, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think Rolling Stone dubbed me the father of falsetto.
Really?
Which is pretty dang neat.
That is cool.
I mean, we were doing falsetto stuff, early on in the late 50s.
Yeah.
We started to perfect it a little bit more and feature it more, in the 60s. And the
right. And when you were doing multi-tracking, you had the opportunity to lay
exactly.
down... You're a standard sounding voice and also the falsetto.
That was fun.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, once we got to multi-tracks, doubling and tripling falsettos really was important to do to kind of fatten them so that they just didn't stick out.
Right.
They kind of were featured, but within a block harmony. Actually, the vocal part just below the falsetto.
Yeah.
Which usually was a kind of a tenor part, was the most important, I thought, was the most important part to support the falsetto and make it stand out.
That totally makes sense. I get that. I got to ask you, though, before we move off of Barbara Ann, is the circumstances under which you recorded that, because some people don't realize the Beach Boys hit Barbara Ann is featuring you on the high falsetto. That's you in the studio. And how did that come to be? Asked Dan knowingly.
You already know the answer, right?
I'm afraid I do.
Of course.
Well, you told me years ago.
You asked.
Yeah.
You asked.
I did.
Because if you don't ask, I don't even think about it.
What song were you and Jan working on?
Well, let me just finish the thought that you said about finding out. My daughter, who just turned 30, my oldest, she, and very much into music, just like 2 or 3 days ago, she said, I didn't know you sang lead on Barbara Ann.
Your daughter
did. She's been to concerts and seen me sing it. She's seen me on stage with the Beach Boys singing it, and they always put me way out in front when the Barbara Ann thing comes.
Yep.
There was a reason for that. I guess she never really thought about that. She just thought maybe I sang a background part, which initially that's all I was going to do. The project was the Beach Boys Party LP.
Right.
You see?
Yeah.
And the whole idea, actually the backstory, just briefly, Brian was working on Pet Sounds. Very complicated.
Yeah.
And a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
His best, by the way, I think.
That you can't rush. I mean, he was being meticulous about it, as he should be, because such absolutely songs that will probably be around for hundreds of years.
I agree. Yep.
So he's working on it and working on it, and the rest of the guys are out on the road. Brian chose to stay at home and produce and arrange the records because that's what he enjoyed doing, and he did not get that big of a kick out of singing live on stage. So he excused himself from going on the road and just said, I want to sit at home. I don't have time to write if I'm on the road. So I want to sit at home and create this music. And then when you guys get off the road, I'll teach it to you and we'll go from there.
In the studio, yeah.
So it's a long process, especially if you're working on God Only Knows or one of those
really,
you know, great complicated songs or even Good Vibrations.
Right.
And the record company, they just want product. They're not necessarily into the art of it all. It's a business, you know.
Right.
And they need product pumped into the pipeline. That's kind of a surfer thing. That's kind of a little surfer fun there.
Okay, I got it.
So good, thank you. I'm glad. Have to explain those things.
I thought that was a business term, but no. Okay, keep going.
Well, see, there you go. So you have the record company calling and calling and going, where is the next Beach Boy album? Where is this thing that you're working on? We probably didn't even have a title for it, but it became Pet Sounds. And he said, I'm working on it. They said, well, you know, we used to get music out of you a lot quicker. You know, it was 409 and I Get Around.
Yeah, easier, pretty, simpler songs.
Pretty simple, you know, simple stuff. Well, that's what they want. You're not doing a second version of Little Deuce Coupe?
Right, yep.
So they weren't invited to the studio, and at the time he had kind of had a home studio that he did most of his work out of. So they weren't invited. They had no idea what he was doing. But all they knew was that there was no release to put out there.
Yep.
So they kept bothering him, months and months of phone calls. Where is it? Hurry up. We needed it. About that time, he started kicking around ideas of what to do. Since we were going to school 5 days a week, most of the year, we were in the studio kind of after school. So when he did go into a regular studio to do something, we were kind of all there together all the time.
By school, at this point, you mean college. You're in architecture school and Jan's in med?
Yeah, pre-med.
Pre-med.
Which is just as bad. It's a lot of work.
Yes.
So the only time we had to record was obviously after school, and then Jan was certifiably a genius, IQ of at least, I think, in the high 170s, maybe 80s.
Wow, smart guy.
So he was one of those that could read something and remember it, kind of that photographic memory thing.
Jealous.
But he did have to study, but he could study after anything we did in the studio if it wasn't too late. So we'd be around Brian sometimes 5 days a week, and he would want us to come in, you know, we'd be next door maybe, and we'd come in and listen to what he was doing and ask if we liked it or any ideas. And then he'd do the same when he was on break, come over and see what we were doing.
Right.
And somewhere in there, he did mention that, you know, I'm working on any play to some of the stuff on Pet Sounds. And my God, this was cutting edge stuff. And he said, but, you know, the reality was that the record company keeps calling him every day and trying to rush him. And he doesn't want to rush this thing. And they're just bothering him, as usual. That's what they do. So he said he had this idea maybe doing a live record. We all knew whenever we needed to release something quickly for the record company, you know, you could always fill in between your real studio records. You just do something live, give it to the record company, it'll keep them busy for 2 or 3 months, and then they'd start bugging you again.
Yeah.
So he said, that's a really good idea. Why don't you do a live record? We've done those before when we just needed to get something in the pipeline and keep the company happy. And he said, well, you know, I want to do a party. I want to record something spontaneous like we did when we were younger, at high school, and have a bunch of people over and mostly acoustic instruments. You know, you could do that in 2 recording sessions, 2 or 3. And even if you tried it at somebody's house, which they did try and do, and then ultimately ended up in a studio and just set up the studio as a party environment because it just didn't work in somebody's house. But it was still spontaneous. They still had their friends. They said, and you guys, you know, we're all friends, and I want you to be a part of it. We'll have plenty of pictures on it from the party, and you'll be featured. And some of our other friends, like Bruce Johnston and Terry Melcher and those guys. And it'll be a bunch of friends all at a real party where you have drinks and beers and food and dates and wives, and everybody will sing along. We said, great idea. So we'll just call it the Beach Boys Party Records. Said, wonderful.
Okay.
I had sung on background on stuff, on some of their stuff before, and never really got any credit because I wasn't supposed to be on it, and record companies didn't like it.
Well, yeah, you were a different label, and there were all kinds of legalities around.
Yeah, a bunch of crap. And Brian had sang on a ton of our stuff because, again, he was in the studio and he'd listen to something and we were about to do some parts. And he'd go, hey, can I sing? Sure, love it if you sang. And he would have an idea, and his ideas were, he couldn't buy better ideas.
Yeah, I believe it.
And they would just flow off of him. So we loved it whenever he said, oh, I got an idea for a part, I'll teach it to you.
Nice.
And so on. So now we're going to do the same kind of thing, but actually get credit for it.
So
and
you thought.
We will be featured in the pictures on Capitol Records.
Right.
So at this point, now that you're actually not underground anymore, but doing it more legally, we did need to go to the record company and say, okay, this is what we're going to be involved in with Brian and the other guys. And just giving you a heads up.
How'd that go?
They said, no. We'll only agree to let you do this. Isn't that nice of them?
Yeah.
After making them millions of dollars. Is that if you need to get a contract from the Beach Boys saying they will, you know, be involved in one of your next projects where we can use their likenesses and give them credit.
Ugh.
We said, no, you know, we don't really do anything by a contract. It's more a handshake. And of course, and Brian's been singing on our stuff. You've made millions off of stuff that Brian's already been giving to us.
Yeah.
And so a handshake's fine. They'll do it. Oh, no. This has to be done legally. And we fought with them back and forth, and they insisted that a legal agreement be drawn up. We just said we didn't want to do that.
Okay.
And, you know, they were a little uncomfortable doing that, too, but they said they would. So I trusted them that later down the line, we would do a project together where they would be featured. And so, no, pretty much our company said, if you participate and we find out that you participate, we're going to hold up your royalties.
Oh, no.
Yes, sir.
Jeez.
Janet bought a nice new house in Bel Air.
And he's in pre-med.
And he's pre-med. And so he thought, well, you know, he didn't need to be sued or have his royalties held up. So I was living at home with my parents. I didn't care. Hold up my royalties, so what? But, you know, I said, okay, yeah, okay. Because Jan was insistent, we can't go over that line or they're going to make our lives miserable.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, we end up in the studio on the same night that Brian decides he's, you know, now going to have this party in the studio.
But you're working on a different song in a different studio, right?
Right.
Right.
We're across the hall.
Okay.
But maybe, you know, 50 yards from that studio.
Gotcha.
So we're close enough that we can kind of almost hear it going on. Anyway, we're working on something, and you asked what song that was. I kept thinking it was one of our lame ballads. And I don't know, I pulled one out that I thought was a lame ballad. I think it was You Really Know How to Hurt a Guy.
That's what you told me before, yeah. That's the title you told me years and years ago.
I think it may or may not be, and the nerds all seem to know what song it really was.
Well, that hurt.
Well, of course you are. You wouldn't be doing what you... Never mind. Anyway.
Okay. So you're 50 yards away from the party.
We count on you nerds. Yeah. You know? Nerds are important.
You secretly like us.
Oh, we need you. Yeah. I don't know if we like you, but we need you.
You said that last episode, Dean.
Well, see, I'm still spouting the story.
You're consistent.
So anyway, it was whatever it was. It was a lame ballad. And, you know, it was an okay song. I didn't mind the song per se. I just didn't think Janadine should be doing sappy ballads and branding. Jan didn't really understand branding.
Okay.
It was just if it was a song he liked, he wanted to do it. And I would always view it through kind of the prism of, well, yeah, that's a nice song, and there's a lot of nice songs. I mean, I like Johnny Mathis songs. That doesn't mean we're going to be singing Johnny Mathis.
Right.
But Jan, if he liked the song, he wanted to perform it. We would butt heads a little bit, but I would just state my opinion and just say Jan Dean shouldn't be singing these kinds of songs. But, you know, I'm not going to boycott and not come to the studio, of course. I'll participate.
Right.
So I had one of those songs, and at a point we had a little bit of a break, or the engineer needed to do something. And I said, hey, I'm going to go down the hall and check out the Beach Boys recording session, the party.
Right.
And Jen goes, oh, yeah, well, okay, but, you know, be back in 10 minutes or so, and make sure not sing. I said, oh, don't worry, I'm not going to sing.
Right.
Okay.
And you didn't intend to. You did not intend to, is my best guess.
Well, I didn't know one way or another. No, I didn't go down there thinking for sure I was going to sing. I just want to say hello and hear what they were doing. I only had 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So what am I going to do in 10 minutes?
Yep.
So I walk in the door, and just it was kind of lucky they were in between trying to pick the next song to do, and they had a little list of songs. I said, hey, Dean, wow, you know what? Come on in. What do you want to sing? I said, oh, what songs are you doing? And they kind of named a few, and there were a few doo-woppers. And I said, well, you know, right, okay, I'll do it. How about a doo-wopper? We'll do another one. I said, okay, what do you want to do? I said, whatever I do, it needs to be... I'm looking at my watch. Now it needs to be 9 minutes. or Jan'll come looking for me. So let's pick something simple that we all know, that we don't have to rehearse. We don't have to sit down and write the lyrics to something we all know.
Yep.
And I said, what about Barbara Ann? Everybody knows that, right? Yeah, okay. We don't have to rehearse it. Let's just do it. Roll. So they kind of get halfway through. So I'm going to sing just harmonies with the other guys.
Right.
And Brian's going to sing the lead. All set up. So we're on two different microphones. And Brian's all by himself singing his lead. And I'm with probably Mike. And I think maybe Bruce was there. And Carl, of course. And I think Dennis sang on it. So we're going to sing the block harmonies. And Brian's going to do the lead. So... we get halfway through the first take, and then Brian stops it. He doesn't like the key or something. It was something he wanted to change. And I'm going, okay. I'll hurry up.
Okay.
And then, all right, now we're ready for the second take. So second take, halfway through, again, he stops it. There's something he wants to change.
Oh, and you're running out of time.
Vocal part, and I'm looking, and now I'm down to about 3 minutes. I knew I had a little bit of extra time probably, but yeah, I didn't want Jan coming, you know, because these doors aren't locked. He could just walk in.
He could be parental, couldn't he?
Yeah, I mean, well, he'd be legitimately worried about, you know, because of the damn record company. And
right. Nope. Valid.
He would love to. And this had this wonderful ballad he was working on. But he would be concerned, let's say.
Okay. Right? Yep. I got it.
He just didn't want to gamble on it. It'd just not be up front in the record company's face, like, I'm doing it anyway.
Right.
One of those things.
Right. Yep.
So I'm looking at my watch, and third take. And all of this is on a recording that came out maybe 3 or 4 years ago with the full, all three takes and all the chatter
really?
In between.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really, really neat. Okay, take three. That's about all the time we're going to have to get it on this take. And it's supposed to be funky anyway. And even in the take we used, half of us are singing some words and the other half singing something else.
Yep.
It was okay. We kind of chuckle in it. It's not supposed to be a studio record.
Well, it's so spontaneous. I heard that some people are playing ashtrays in it and things like that.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. The ones that weren't singing were just hitting stuff and kind of in the background singing along.
Okay.
So that was cool. That's the way it was supposed to sound.
The whole
point. So that was fine.
Yeah.
Okay, take three. And then Brian says, and you can hear this on the recording, Brian says, Dean, come sing with me. Let's do the falsettos together. Like, you know, he's thinking like Surf City and Drag City and a bunch of others that we sang falsetto parts, you know, together. Because my falsetto has more top end, his has more mid-range and bottom, and the two of them together have kind of a full-range sound we kind of like.
Okay.
So he said, come over here and then we'll sing a falsetto together. And Mike says, all right, well, he's good over here. You know, we're doing the block harmonies sound really, really good. Brian said, no, I want him over here. And they're almost arguing. Yeah. And I'm looking at my watch going, I don't care which group I'm in, I don't know which microphone, but we really need to, you know, figure out what we're going to do and do it. So Brian wins because
he's Brian. Producer.
He's Brian. So I go over to his microphone. Well, I sing a lot louder than he does. But, you know, I didn't even think of it. In the studio, we would do it a few times, and I would find where I should stand and all of that.
Yeah.
And in this case, we really needed to just do it. So Brian counts it off. We sing Barbara Ann all the way through. We make it right down to the end. And then we're having so much fun that this is a version where it keeps starting again.
Okay, yeah.
Somebody says, you know, one more time. And then it got me rock and roll, got me Barbara Ann.
Yep.
So one more time, and it got me rocking. And so it got to be a bit. You know, it was kind of funny. We started it at the end about three more times.
Yeah, like three false endings on that version.
Three false endings, and then the big false ending with a one more time, and it goes into halftime, kind of a blues ending.
Yep.
Which was great. What a great idea. And then it kind of ends with everybody kind of singing off key and a little weird and
being
really
at
having a good time.
And being at a party.
Yeah, I'm going out the door while it's still almost kind of ending. And Carl says, thanks, Dean. I said, fun, great. I had a good time. And out the door I went, luckily. And I got out that door before Jan came down. I go into our studio, and he's laboring away at this
ballad.
Stupid ballad. And then someone said, well, you know, what songs were they doing? I said, well, I was there. The only one I heard was Barbara Ann. He said, did you sing? I said, no. thinking, who's going to know, right? All those falsettos kind of sound alike.
Right, yeah.
Damn, they left the end where Carl says, thanks, Dean, and walking out the door. And they left that on.
They left that on. That's on the record. Dead giveaway. Busted.
Yeah, I guess I got busted for that. But luckily, record executives actually don't listen to anything. So
they figured Dean was the engineer or something, right?
I guess. I don't know. Or they said Gene or Bean. I don't know.
Wow.
Anyway, I didn't get busted. And that song was, I think, their second best-selling single ever?
Probably.
I mean, it was never meant to be a single. See, I just thought of it as an album filler.
Yeah.
No singles on there.
You just thought of it as a party.
Yeah, so it's a party, and it's a bunch of people all singing. Who knows who's singing? And it's never, if it's not blatantly as a single or anything, it's just an album filler. This is a stupid Barbara Ann.
And all of a sudden, it hits number one, and...
Oh, well, you're all scratching our heads going, I'm looking at the gold record right now.
You've got a copy of the gold record. Cool.
That's what I got paid, was the gold record.
Well, you know, that's not a bad payday.
And on the little plaque, it says, I'm looking at it, it says, thanks, Dean, for bringing, and that's what they said, you know,
right
at the end of the recording.
Right.
Thanks, Dean. That's big type. And then a little bit smaller says, for bringing Barbara Ann to our party, the boys.
Oh,
got a nice little plaque.
That's nice. What a
Isn't
nice.
That cool?
Yeah. Wow. Well,
that's very cool.
Your career has always been married to that of the Beach Boys. And in fact, Jan and Dean inspired the Beach Boys because you had hits before Jan and Dean. You even beat the Beach Boys. Jan and Dean beat the Beach Boys to number one.
Yep. That was the first surf song to hit number one on the charts was Surf City.
Surf City. And it turns out that had a big splash all around the world. I know Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones was a huge fan of surf music. And there was a little cult following in England at the time. But that song has gone all the way around the world. I understand from a reliable source that you guys, Jan and Dean, played China. Yeah?
Yeah.
Wow. When?
Just don't ask me. Well, I know you already asked me how that came to be.
Yeah,
I don't actually remember. A friend of a friend of a friend of a friend was working with music people that were trying to put stuff together for China.
Was this like an ambassador kind of program kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, hands across the water?
Because the Chinese were kind of wanting to open it up a little bit and, you know, do some American stuff. I think they had a few other music entities, probably more from Europe, come play.
Yeah.
But they hadn't really had anybody from the States do real concerts. I think John Denver went and did one or two shows in one form or another. But they'd never really had a, in quotes, rock and roll band from America.
And how did Jan and Dean come to be picked?
Just friends of friends that were involved with the Chinese government had asked certain entities to see if they could, you know, put something together and present it to them. And a group of folks from L.A. were dealing with the same. It's a cultural board in Shanghai. So they literally, once they decided, I guess in all the presentations, they picked us because of the culture. See, they did want the culture to be one of the most prominent parts of the music.
Okay, yeah.
And wanted, they kind of liked that whole surfing and car culture and all that. Thought the Chinese would be very interested in that from California.
That sealed the deal.
So they did send some folks over from the cultural board to check us out, make sure we weren't political and all that, which we weren't, and then said, yeah, this would be very cool.
How many concerts did you play in China?
I think we did either six or seven in Shanghai, and then did two in a place called Guangzhou, and then two in Shenzhen. And each time we moved a little bit closer to Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong, there was radio, the mainland Chinese, the People's Republic Chinese, were getting radio stuff from Hong Kong that they could listen to.
Okay.
So that's where they were getting, and television.
Almost like pirate radio for them. Pirate radio?
Yeah. More or less.
Yeah.
They could have probably stopped it if they wanted to, but they kind of let it come in because they were going to be merging with Hong Kong relatively soon.
Right.
So they did want to know what was going on in Hong Kong. So they let the Chinese people hear what was going on in Hong Kong, which was much different than what the average Chinese person was hearing in the People's Republic of China. So anyway, I kind of, before I really found out and asked those questions, I did notice when I turned on the TV at night in my room, there were a whole lot of shows in English.
Really?
And obviously most of it was Chinese. And I kept checking the channels, and there was nothing in Japanese, nothing in German or
so. Are you talking about Chinese originated programs that the Chinese were performing in English?
No, they were getting older broadcasts of stuff, just catalog stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, there was old cowboy, movies and stuff. Yeah. Pretty strange.
Had to be strange. Yes. Go to China and see a Roy Rogers movie. That's pretty weird, you know?
Yeah, it was. It was very strange. And they liked the 50s stuff. Doris Day had a hit there.
Really? Wow.
They were a little bit more into middle-of-the-road music, not necessarily rock and roll, but they were starting to get interested in rock and roll.
So how were the crowds? How were you greeted by the crowds? Did they know the songs? Did they yell? Did they cheer? Did the girls scream? What was the reaction?
We played in a 20,000-seater basketball arena.
Okay.
And the stage was set up on the floor, obviously, on the basketball floor. And we showed up at the first concert in Shanghai. We'd set everything up earlier in the day.
Yeah.
And done a sound check, and it all worked. And
yeah.
Then went back to the hotel, got dressed, and had a little dinner, and then headed to the arena.
Right.
And pulled into the parking lot, and there were no cars.
Oh. Oh.
And I went, shit. this is a stiff. Because as a band that plays live, you're used to kind of checking out the parking lot when you arrive.
Right, yeah, see what the crowd's like.
Whether or not it worked or didn't work, or yep. People are interested or weren't. I don't even remember seeing a car, but there must have been one or two.
Wow.
We pulled up earlier in the day, went into our dressing rooms, and the dressing rooms were right off of the main part of the arena.
Right.
They were literally 10 or 15 feet from the door that led into the arena, and I couldn't hear anything. So I told our guide, who was from the cultural board, Haiping. I said, Haiping, what? And he spoke pretty good English.
Yeah.
So what happened?
I don't hear anybody in the crowd.
Is this the right night? He said, oh, yeah, this is the right night. I said, well, what happened? He said, what do you mean? I said, there's nobody here. He said, oh, no, it's full.
Really?
Every seat.
Really?
They're quiet.
Well, okay.
And they ride bicycles.
Oh.
None of them have cars.
Oh, okay.
Most of the populace, the only people with cars were government.
Okay.
Folks. So no wonder there are no cars in the parking lot. But they had a parking lot because they're expecting cars. And they're moving in that direction. That's the whole idea.
Oh, okay.
But we weren't quite there yet. There were 20,000 people.
Wow.
Every seat taken.
And did they know the songs, Dean?
No.
They didn't.
They didn't care.
They
were just happy
really?
To see Americans. They loved Americans, especially the younger people.
Oh.
Because younger people, most all Chinese lived, with almost most all of them lived together three generations.
Sure.
Grandma and granddad.
Yep.
And he had mom and dad, and then the kids.
Yeah.
Huh. And that mom and dad would go off to work, and grandma and granddad were the ones that pretty much taught the kids, made sure they, went to school. And they would talk a lot about World War II.
Really?
How the Japanese came and invaded them and were brutal to them. They hated the Japanese.
I'll be.
For that. Guess who came to their aid? Those loony Americans.
Yes, yes.
They're flying tigers and all of that.
John Wayne was a flying tiger, but that was that's a movie title. I'm sorry, but that
yep, it's relevant. And it was the Americans that came, and they well understood that some Americans died to protect them and chase the Japanese out of China. The Doolittle Raiders
yes
crashed a couple of airplanes in China after their raid. they were supposed to try and make it to China. There were some airstrips where they could land.
Right.
You know, guys died bombing Japan and then trying to make it to China.
Well,
so they knew all that. And my keyboard player, his dad was a Doolittle Raider, and they knew all about, the younger people did, and the grandparents knew all about the Doolittle Raiders and the Flying Tigers and all of that.
Sure, yeah.
So it was very, very cool.
That's a big feather in the Jana Dean cap.
Wow. It was so cool. We had a really, really, we were there 3.5 weeks, almost 4 weeks, and played most of the shows there in Shanghai. They were sold out every night, and they asked us if we wanted to stay, and they could sell it out a bunch more times. But Christmas was coming up. We were supposed to be home for Christmas.
What year was this?
We'll come back. 86, going into 87.
Okay.
Tiananmen Square happened. We started getting linked to, because the crowds were getting more excited, more animated when they found out how much they could animate, get excited.
Oh.
Although the watchful eye was there, and there were Red Guard guys with guns.
You're saying that perhaps Jan and Dean enabled some of that Chinese protest that happened that culminated in Tiananmen Square.
There's an article in USA Today that directly linked us to, you know, the student rebellion in Tiananmen Square.
That's remarkable. Wow. That's so cool. Dean, that's so cool.
Well, that's very cool. I was an activist, T.
Yeah, you radical. You rebel, you.
And they loved it. I mean, they loved the idea of freedom. We had a big video screen where we showed them if we were singing about surfing. They got to see what surfing looked like.
So, and that was so the cultural part of it.
Yeah. And the cars and the beach and all of that kind of stuff, Southern California stuff.
Yeah.
And they came in glued. I would ride a bicycle around the arena, and they loved the fact that I was riding a bicycle like they do. And then I'd crash it, and they loved that because they couldn't. We were loony Americans that could afford to bend a bicycle and not care about it.
And their fascination with bicycles perhaps transferred over to the other form of transportation that you promoted, meaning skateboards.
So Lorimar Television shot most all the shows, and so there were cameras around. So I took that opportunity to be the first person to ever skateboard on the Great Wall. Actually, we have it on film.
Oh, man. I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, you need a plaque for that, Dean.
And, you know, it sounds good, but the disclaimer is that the Great Wall is made with big square pieces of maybe even granite. And probably these squares are maybe 5 or 6 feet by 6 feet. And, of course, they're kind of laid next to one another, and there's mortar in between them. And over the years, the mortar's kind of worn out. So you could skate about one little block of granite, and then the wheels would drop down into the mortar and where the mortar should be. And then if you were skilled enough, you could get the wheels up before it got stuck in between, you know, the blocks. But most of the time, I only went a couple of feet. It's on film.
But it was
really fun. Of course, the Chinese went crazy over that.
Hey, I want to go way, way back to your very early days, not to change the subject because it's fascinating. But I one of the standard questions I like to ask everybody is, where were you, and how did you react the first time you heard yourself on the radio?
I got sick to my stomach.
Really? You threw up?
I almost threw up.
Okay. The nerves?
I was excited, but nervous.
Okay. You were in the car, and it was what, KHJ?
I got sweaty. I think the first time I heard, I was a lifeguard at a pool in West Los Angeles, and I think I had a portable radio, and I was told possibly they were going to play the song. I was the only one listening to the radio. Everybody else was in the pool. You know, I was a lifeguard, so I
You
sat
could.
There.
You had to. You couldn't go in the pool.
And, man, it was so cool.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, you almost threw up into the pool. That's interesting.
Yep.
I have to
clean out the pool.
My other question is, and I promised that I would ask this in part one, I promised I would ask this question.
Who'd you promise?
I promised both my listeners that...
Okay, good. Oh, them.
Yeah, them. I promise.
The same ones that write me once a week.
I promised them that I would bring up the fact that you have showered with James Brolin.
Yeah.
A reluctant topic. Should you want to quick explain
that? Well, no, I mean, I would have never thought any of my friends would have married Barbara Streisand, but to each their own, I guess.
The explanation is he was a high school friend that you played sports with, so after practice, you'd be in the showers with James Brolin.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we were all high school seniors and all playing different, you know, different discipline sports. And he wasn't on the football team, but he would have been a tennis player probably.
Okay.
Ryan O'Neal was part of that group too.
Really?
James Brolin. Yeah, Brolin was his name. Was just for a little backstory here. His name was Jim Brudelin. He was
okay.
In high school, and then O'Neal, Ryan O'Neal. His name was Pat O'Neal.
Interesting.
And
so James Brolin, Brudelin, married Barbara Streisand, and Ryan O'Neal, your other buddy from high school that we're talking about here, starred in a movie with Barbara Streisand. What's up, Doc?
Oh, God. Only you would know something nerdy like that.
Well, I just put the two together because I didn't know about Ryan O'Neal.
But that's what you would do as a nerd. I would say, you know, if I was talking about Ryan O'Neal, I'd say he married Farrah Fawcett. That made sense, man.
Yeah.
What a lucky dude he was.
Oh, man.
They were a nice pair. They lasted a long time together. I was happy for him.
Yeah.
And then saddened for him. He's never really gotten over losing her. I hear she was a neat lady.
Yeah.
She probably was.
Well, looks like there's going to be a part 3 of my interview with Dean Torrence. And in that episode, you're going to hear Dean tell the story of Jan's devastating car accident in 1966 and how Dean found out about it. And you're going to find out why Jan and Dean were not allowed to be in the movie Ride the Wild Surf, even though they sang the title track to the movie. Not only were they not in the movie, they weren't even allowed on the set. And the reason why... pretty bizarre. That's all in part 3 on the next installment of Dan Marcus's Wax Museum. Again, find more at danmarcuswaxmuseum.com and on Facebook at Dan Marcus's Wax Museum. Thank you.